Let's say 100,000 years from now, there may not be any archaeologists, but if there are, what will they dig up that tells them that we ever existed? The change may be pretty obvious, marked perhaps by plastic, radiation, maybe something ecological. Good morning, I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. What does it mean that humans have brought the Earth into a new geologic age? Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Exploring the Anthropocene is the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is one of those ideas that takes a while to sink in. It's sort of a colossal idea. The idea that, yes, we've changed the Earth. We have created a new geologic age. The Earth, the glaciers receded 12,000 years ago. They had this little younger Dryas. They came back for a little bit, and then they receded. And ever since then, we've had a progressive civilization. And now that era is known as the Holocene. But now we've come to a different era. We have turned the corner, and it's pretty clear that human beings have actually altered the planet. So the question then, perhaps, becomes, how do we handle this? How do we take responsibility for what we have already done and what we will do in the future? And it's my great pleasure to, this is a concept that is in a number of books that have been coming out in the last few years. And in this case, it was broached about 2010 in a book entitled Menschenweit by Christian Schwegel. Do I have that right, Christian?
Yes, absolutely, Steve. Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm in Copenhagen, capital of Denmark, and I'm on a tour here to discuss the Anthropocene with people in Europe. And so I'm happy to discuss it with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you could make the time to be with us, because I know the publication reception and everything is coming up early next month in London, but I wanted to get you on ahead of time, and I'm glad you can make the time for us. And I think I will start with this, Christian. First off, introducing you as a longtime correspondent journalist for Der Spiegel, with a longtime interest, particularly in this climate change issue. I would say that would be a fair characterization. But you go beyond that into other scientific areas as well. And I think I would start by asking you, when did you, as a journalist, as a person, when did you begin to start to give some credence to this idea that human beings have created a new geologic era?
Yeah, I think for me, it also took some time to kind of understand what this new idea is about, Anthropocene, the geological era of humans. I mean, we kind of all grew up with the idea of, you know, there are environmental problems. So, you know, humans are doing something to Earth. But I think often the idea was, you know, we are kind of causing some kind of wounds in the Earth, or scratching only the surface of Earth, in a sense. And I think a lot of people are still thinking that, you know, if humans cease to exist in a way, the nature would go back to some, you know, previous state or so. And the Anthropocene idea really says, no, we are kind of reorganizing how the Earth works. And, I mean, for me personally, I think I started thinking about this from very early on. I think the earliest experience, actually, in that Anthropocene experience I had was with my father when I was about 5 years old or so. So back in the 1970s, and we brought some waste to a waste dump. You know, as you did in the time, you just drove it to a kind of municipal waste dump and just put it there. And when we drove back, my father said to me, he like looked at me and said, "One day they will drill there for resources." So I think that triggered kind of my environmental awareness. And I mean, today it's true in Europe, you know, people start drilling deep into former landfills to extract resources. That's already happening now. And I mean, we have changed the geology of Earth, you know, with landfills, for example, but that's just one of really a whole long list of examples that all add up to this Anthropocene, the age of humans.
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation there, and especially when, as I learned from your book, you can actually go into a landfill and find finer grades of certain metals used in making microprocessors, certain rare metals, in far greater abundance than you can find them in any ore on Earth.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, when we talk about a new geological age, I mean, first it's about, you know, rocks and minerals and so on. Of course, it also includes life on Earth and evolution and nature and everything. But yeah, with the minerals, that is a very interesting point that really, if you look at electronic waste, it contains more gold per ton than actually gold ore, right? So what we now see as waste will be a resource of the future, and we should make sure, that's, you know, my interpretation of Anthropocene, for example, that perhaps we don't treat things as waste in the first place, but we create an economy that doesn't know waste, in a sense, because everything's going in cycles, and we need, you know, engineers and scientists and designers to come up with better products that don't end up as waste, but become new things, right?
Yeah. So there's this this idea of responsibility. If we did actually change it, and now we need to start running it, and it has gotten to the point. And one thing that you point out in the book, I want to get back to this issue of, is there even a wild nature at all anymore? But first, I want to go to this other thing that there are actually now, because of the way populations have changed their distribution, there are parts of Europe, I know, and also parts here in the United States where the population is actually emptied out. There's no economic incentive for people to be there anymore, not even farming, and they have gone back to a wild state. And in some cases, then, even in urban landscapes, we see certain species that really are at home in these urban environments. Yep. And our concept of reality doesn't want to call that nature, you know what I mean?
Nature, that's right. So I think that is one really important aspect of this Anthropocene idea, that, I mean, so far we make these big differences between, you know, what is nature and what is culture. And, I mean, you described some empty spaces on Earth. The thing is, I mean, of course, with human population increasing to, it's now at 7.2 billion people, it will increase up to 11 billion people. The agricultural, as is, you know, that's a forecast for the year 2100, the agricultural area humans have created, I mean, you know, imagine 10,000 years ago, it was just a few patches in the Middle East. Now it's the size of South America, right? So our food needs and food, you know, tastes, our taste for meat in particular, makes it necessary to farm an area the size of the whole of South America, for example. And the cities are growing. There will almost be 5% of the land surface of Earth will be cities in the foreseeable future. So if you add all that together, the kind of human systems have spread on planet Earth in the last 200 years in a way that is almost unheard of in Earth history, that such a fundamental change. One species kind of, you know, expanding over the whole planet. And I mean, along the fact that the Earth is now lit at night, on the dark, on the side that was dark until 200 years ago, which now lit up. That also is a very strong symbol of this Anthropocene. And so now we have to, we live with this idea that there's always this bigger nature around us, and that's why we call it the environment. You know, it's something that is around us and where we can extract resources from and where we can dump our waste into and dilute it. Now, the Anthropocene idea kind of says, no, you know, this is not the case anymore. We become the nature of the planet because we are so ubiquitous. We are everywhere. And our ways of life, they kind of extend into the last corner of the planet, even into the deepest rainforest and even into the polar areas where climate change is taking place. So human activities, in a way, are everywhere. And that's why Anthropocene thinkers say, you know, we become the nature of the planet. And that, you know, makes us, puts us in a place of responsibility that we haven't had so far.
We're speaking with Christian Schwegel, who is the author of The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet. He's talking to us by telephone from Copenhagen, and this book is just about to be published. We're talking to him pre-publication, although it came out a couple of years ago in German, but it has been translated and also extensively revised with more up-to-date information. And it's a fascinating thing, and it's a concept that takes a while to soak in. And the implications, the more I think about it, the more implications come up. Christian, one thing.
Yeah, so it was invented by, perhaps that's important to discuss. It was invented or coined by, not by me. I mean, I've written a book about it because I found the topic so interesting. But the person who, or two persons that are really the ones who started this as a scientific hypothesis. I mean, it's not an ideology or a religion or anything like that. It is a very hardcore natural science idea, hypothesis, and the guy most associated with is Paul Crutzen. He's a Dutch scientist. He's a Nobel laureate because he discovered, as one of the first researchers, that gases, humans produce artificial synthetic gases, can harm the ozone layer that protects us from UV radiation from space. And he was in the 70s pointing to that there are substances, and that led to political measures to protect the ozone layer. And so the fact that we can walk around now without getting sunburn or skin cancer pretty fast is due to Paul Crutzen's research. And so this fact that we had produced the, you know, the CFC gases in like cooling sprays and refrigerators and so on, almost accidentally, without knowing that we would harm the ozone layer with it. That kind of really shocked him, and that made him think about, you know, what else humans do with the planet. And so in the year 2000, he, at a scientific conference, he came up with that word, and it stunned scientists, and it keeps stunning scientists that, you know, you could kind of get one word, Anthropocene, the new era of humans, summarizing so much what we do with the planet.
Yeah, and now one of the most charming parts of your book is when you talk about the scientific society that's in charge of deciding about geologic layers and what they're likely to do with this. And you say this is probably going to take years for them to decide what the markers might be. But, you know,
next year we will get a first kind of vote from the scientific community, and that is very exciting. So, I mean, these guys are kind of the keepers of Earth's time, you know. I mean, it's only a couple of hundred years that we know how old Earth is, that it's 4 billion years old. And since then, these geologists have started dividing Earth's history, this very deep, very long history, up into chapters and subchapters, and paragraphs in a sense, and these guys are in charge of the Earth time, and so they now decide whether we kind of open a new chapter in Earth history, and they will come up with a first vote in 2016, but it might take some time until it's really formalized.
Yeah, you know, last week I had Jeremy Mathis on, who is a specialist in ocean acidification, and he was talking about the Earth process of how the Earth deals with its carbon, and how it ends up in the soil, it ends up in the sediments in the ocean, and he's saying that that process is a matter of hundreds of years. And the carbon that we've put into the atmosphere and hence acidified our oceans is a process that's taking care to happen in just a few years. So it's not something that the Earth can on its own recover from. And I had no, it really took me aback that it was to be hundreds of years. It has to be hundreds of years before geologic processes would be able to deal with this. And that sort of tips it once again. It's like how many other geologic processes that are going to take quite a long time to go through cycles to get back to, well, no, there is no getting back to. That's the whole point, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, and that is an important point. There is, in the Anthropocene, there is no getting back to. It's something new, and what you describe, ocean acidification, that everything will go through our exhaust pipes, through the chimneys and everything, all the carbon that comes out of our industries and the burning forests and so on, it goes somewhere. And I mean, we all know from fizzy water that it can be refreshing, but it can also be very uncomfortable when you swallow it, if it's too fizzy, if there is too much gas into it. And that's what we make ocean creatures feel increasingly, because a lot of the carbon we put into the air is exactly the fizzy component of bubbling water, right? And so we cause a lot of damage to ocean life, and potentially will cause a lot of damage to us, because the fish we eat depends on the small stuff in the ocean, the algae and everything, and they might suffer actually from these extra carbon. And your point that it takes a long time, that is the Anthropocene. What we do is not something that will go away within a couple of decades or 100 years. A lot of what happens also with new life forms that are bred in laboratories or for agriculture, or life forms that get extinct, that just vanish, or think about radioactive waste, think about the plastic and everything. We already now communicate with the deep future. Our civilization is sending messages into a very deep future, thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, and that makes it geological, the whole debate, that says, this is so big that even in 100,000 years, you can still measure it, you can still see it, and people will know what we have done. So we better think about what we do.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, and you are cordially welcome to join the conversation with Christian Spregel, author of The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet. He's with us by telephone from Copenhagen. And, it's interesting that you are in Copenhagen because, of course, that's where the whole Kyoto process, I guess we would call it,
climate change treaties, mm-hmm.
It sort of fell apart. But you note right towards the end of your book, you said Copenhagen may have felt a little guilty about that because they've gone on to green themselves as a city.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, that's a very positive effect. I think, this was in 2009, the United Nations conference here in Copenhagen, where everyone thought this would be the moment when, humans get their act together, when governments kind of reach a consensus on how to reduce our output of carbon dioxide. And they were all there, all the powerful people, including President Obama, and it failed, And the whole idea of getting an agreement fell apart for some time. So, I mean, the city of Copenhagen felt so ashamed to be, the name for this failure, that they have totally increased their green activities since, and And in a very positive way, Copenhagen has become a much more lively, attractive city, more green spaces. The people grow food in the backyards. So they have like what's called urban farming, right? Here, there's much more recycling. And when you get out on the street, you better take care that you're not run over by a cyclist, because the bicycling here is so strong. Car traffic has been reduced, and masses of people here. You almost feel like back in China. You know, tens of thousands of people use their bicycles, and that's fantastic. You know, so you know, this really horrible outcome of a big conference, a global conference, had some really positive effects on the local level. And I think actually that's almost as important, because that's a local life, our daily life, that counts. It's, you know, big politics is one thing, but I think, you know, the way we behave individually as families, as communities, as villages and cities, that's equally important. And that also is connected to this question of the Anthropocene. This may sound like an idea that's almost too big, you know, but it relates to our all-day life, and that's very important.
Well, Christian, I only became aware when I saw the tagline on your email this morning that you have a new book out that came out last fall that has to do with the relationship of people with the cyberspace, I guess you would say. And I'm thinking that maybe social media is an important, first off, it's quite a new thing. Second off, humans are quickly adapting to it in ways that no one could have foreseen. But third off, that it might actually be a potent tool toward this re-engineering, I guess, of human attitude.
Yeah.
Because now we have we've got an economic system that the incentives clearly are to think of the created world as something apart, some place that something you make money from, and then the rest of it is just some batch of resources that you can go and exploit and throw your waste into without having to pay. And this idea of having to pay, you know, is ultimately goes back down to the consumers. And they actually have a new tool now to mobilize their intent, if they had an intent, that is.
No, and I think that is a very important side also of the whole Anthropocene idea, is this global connectedness, you know, and the internet is just one kind of expression of being globally connected. I mean, we now consume goods that have traveled thousands of kilometers before they land on our table or, you know, in our living rooms. When you drive a car, I mean, it is an American brand, perhaps, or it's a German brand, but really it will be made up of, you know, pieces, bits and pieces that come from all over the planet. So we are connected with the planet on a material level. Alaskan oil, you know, where does it go? You know, it might end up in a car, you know, on a different continent, perhaps, right? Or the forest product, you know. And then there is this connection through now electronic means, where we exchange information, and that allows a kind of global consciousness to grow. And we have seen the rise of environmental consciousness over 100 years, and you can trace it much deeper and longer. But certainly our electronic connectedness now helps us to be part of developments and changes elsewhere, and understand them, and perhaps also in the future, electronic means will help us to grow empathy for faraway places. And I think this feeling of global connectedness is very, very important, because you know, what you do in one place today will affect other places. Like if I drive a car here, you know, you will feel it in Alaska through climate change, and your permafrost might melt. And your roads might kind of fall apart because of that, because Europeans or Chinese have behaved in this way and didn't respect, you know, your needs in a sense. So we need this feeling of strong connectedness, and that is actually you know, one element of hope, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about Tuvalu right now, and probably you are too, because I think you were in Copenhagen for some of that, and the people from Tuvalu were there too. And these are people that, when storm surge goes through, they have to hold their children up above their heads to keep them from being washed away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with climate change, I mean, the toughest thing about it, of course, is that it's caused, you know, by, you know, kind of rich people in what we call the developed world, and the people that will suffer most, they are not the one who have caused this. You know, they live in places like Bangladesh, for example, you know, very low-lying places. I mean, if you look at the carbon emissions of Bangladesh, it's, you know, close to nothing. And so it's a very unequal distribution. We now talk a lot about the unequal distribution of wealth that, you know, 1% of humans have as much as billions of others, and there is also an unequal distribution of the consequences. So the people that cause climate change are not the ones that will suffer the most, but quite the opposite. So that makes it even more urgent to act.
Let's go to Tom. Joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Christian Schrigel.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
We need to focus on what to do and proceed forward and not get caught up on what everyone else is doing wrong. Our children and grandchildren's future is dependent on this. To go forward, I have written an 8-page document that establishes the basis for a new political party called the Sunshine Common Sense Party that will take us down the right path. And I've emailed it to you, Steve, and I think you have a copy of it.
Tom, I haven't seen this yet, but I look forward to it.
Yeah, you've got a copy.
Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very good to think about changes. You know, some people who care about the environment, they're depressed and they just talk about kind of the end of the world and things like that. And I think that's not a very good attitude. You know, if we want to do something positive, you know, you need to think forward, and we need to plan for kind of a long future. You know, no sense in kind of climbing down into a bunker and trying to protect yourself from the end of the world. It's much better to do something positive. And so, for example, economies, you know, that are now dependent on extraction, you know, resource extraction, like oil, for example. I mean, you have a lot of countries around the world that have oil, and at the same time, they have very rich biological resources. Like Ecuador, for example, has one of the most biologically diverse rainforests in the world. And the rainforest is on oil resources. So why not pay this country to protect the biological richness, the biological treasures, because that's where we get our medicine from in the future, that you know, stores carbon for us and just will supply us with our future food, because a lot of, you know, plants that we now use as food come from South America, for example. So why not pay for ecological services? I mean, you could say Alaska is providing a lot of ecological services to the world, for example, and to the rest of the United States. So I think it will be really important to give some economic value to ecological services and make them kind of be part of our bookkeeping, in a sense. So far, nature and wilderness and biological diversity doesn't really show up. I mean, okay, yes, with tourism and other things, yes, but not just as a service to humans. And that would be, for me, one way to move ahead, to attribute some economic value to ecological services.
Tom?
Yeah. I've written a document that gives priorities and order in which it's important to do things. I think it would be helpful.
All right, Tom, I want to thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, down in Homer, let's go to Larry. Joins the program from Anchorage. Larry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
Morning.
I first heard about ideas like this probably 30, 40 years ago when I read a book that's even older than that called The Phenomenon of Man, which was written by a
Chardin,
paleontologist and a Jesuit priest, Pierre
Teilhard. Yes, Teilhard de Chardin, yes.
Yes, and one point, now he approached it from a somewhat philosophical and theological level, but all of his work was very much grounded in science, and he raised the, you know, he posited the idea that mankind is evolution gaining consciousness of itself. In other words, we are the earth saying, I am the earth, and everything that goes into that. Now, this, you know, that's an interesting thought, but it begs many questions. Evolution worked in creating a system that functions, you know, sustainably for all, you know, portions of the system, because evolution doesn't care at all about individuals or even about species. If they no longer function well, they drop out, go extinct. If individuals can't function well because of some biological shortcoming, they die. And eventually, everybody else in that population with that genetic makeup dies as well. So, but now here we are, evolution gaining consciousness of itself. We make decisions based on our individual or even social interests. We are not looking at the whole. We are not capable of looking at the whole, at least thus far. Human nature. What do we do about human nature? If we're going to solve these problems, there's going to have to be a fundamental change in human nature where we realize that we are not in it for ourselves. Now, I realize that's a philosophical and religious question that people have argued about, you know, for thousands of years, and no one's come up with the answer yet, or at least all those who come up with answers have died trying to propose them to the rest of the world. So, you know, that's my point, and that's my question: is there any hope as long as we have our egocentric, short-sighted, me first, my country first type of consciousness?
I have a feeling that Christiane has thought about this one, but before you start, Christiane, I want to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer in the United States, but it doesn't have to be. Colorectal cancer screening can prevent cancer by removing polyps before they turn into cancer. Screening can also find this cancer early when treatment works best. So if you're 50 or older, talk with your doctor about which screening test is right for you. More at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
Boy, what a great question from Larry in Anchorage, who said, if human beings embody evolution, why hasn't our attitude changed by this time? Why haven't we evolved? Christiane Schregel is author of The Human Era and the Anthropocene, the human era and how it shapes our planet. He joins us by telephone. Christiane, what can you tell Larry?
Yeah, first of all, I'm very grateful to Larry that he brought in this philosopher and this philosophical question, the philosopher Teilhard de Chardin, who exactly wrote that book, The Phenomenon of Man, and who Paul Crutzen, the scientist who coined the word Anthropocene, actually refers to in his very first publication on the Anthropocene together with Eugene Sturmer. He wrote that, you know, this can be traced back to scientists like Teilhard de Chardin, who said, you know, humans are a way of evolution to become aware of itself and of you know what happened, and that kind of, he put this sort of positive angle on the whole human story, that A, we are a part of this natural system, and B, we, you know, we are about to make conscious decisions of where it goes. And just to support that with, in terms of evolution, I mean, we have talked about, you know, the hard stuff like climate change and resource extraction so far, but in terms of evolution, that's also important that the human mind kind of comes in as a factor deciding, you know, what life looks like in the future, like we are transporting plants and animals around the globe and decide with that where they live. And we now have totally altered compositions of plants and animals and fungi and bacteria around the world because of human activity. In our research labs, we kind of breed new life forms, and actually there are now scientists who shape design life, actually, like Craig Venter in the United States, who is about to do what's called synthetic biology, so actually build organisms molecule by molecule. And so these changes are also part of the Anthropocene, and I think Larry's question of, you know, how will this change our behavior is at the core, because I think the Anthropocene will make us aware of the fragility of human civilization. I mean, we are facing changes which will make some of the crises of today, you know, look probably pale compared to what will come with climate change. For example, the U.S. military says climate change is one of the biggest threats to stability on the planet. And I think we will feel, you know, that our daily actions, you know, what we do, like burning fossil fuels in our daily lives, you know, will have this destabilizing effect. And people, I think with the problems growing, I think our sense of responsibility, it just needs to grow a little bit faster. And what I think is the most important thing is the sense of community. So I think Larry was so to the point when he said, you know, our economic system is kind of, at the moment, is very egotistical. And I'm, you know, totally in favor of the Western free economy system, but it just needs to factor in, you know, the value of community, the value of social actions, the value of the future, the value of nature, and that is something we need to integrate into the economic decisions. But I know, as a species, I think we are very social. We are not born as egotists, in a sense. I mean, humankind has spread over the planet because we are social at the core. I mean, you see a lot of egotism around you every day, and, you know, introspection sometimes reveals egotism in oneself, of course. But yeah, I think fundamentally we are a social species, and that's probably our biggest resource. What do you think, Larry? You think we're, you know, more social than egotistical, or the other way around?
Yeah, Larry's been Larry decided to listen off of the radio there.
So. Right. Okay.
But I
would have been interesting because he made such an interesting point.
Yes. Yeah, we have this is a good point to bring up, that we're talking about things that not very long ago, this, you know, it takes a while for attitudes to change. I mean, I remember when they were saying, well, the division of wealth in the United States, but also now the entire world, can't continue to go the way that it is. I mean, this was in the 90s, and they were saying it's really gotten so bad. The super rich have gotten so super rich, and the poor are getting nowhere, that something's bound to change. And you know, it's still going on. It hasn't. But what you do see is, you see now the corporate sector's greenwashing. In other words, it's very important to them to be perceived as being earth-friendly, whether they are or not is problematical. But they like to be seen as that way, and that is because there's a huge, huge customer base to which these things matter. They are demanding this now of the corporate sector. But what's lacking here is truth in terms of how the costs are actually flowing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, also how, for one really good example of, you know, how to maximize egotism is when you, you know, pay subsidies for the wrong stuff. And if you have an economy that, you know, does not make consumers, you know, act responsibly, where the stuff that is most destructive to the planet is the cheapest, so it has the biggest attractiveness. It should be the other way around, that stuff that hurts the planet should be the most expensive, and stuff that's environmentally friendly, that makes life richer and Earth more healthy, that should be the cheapest, actually. So it, we have a kind of economic incentives that are exactly the opposite of what it should be like. So, like, organic produce should be cheaper because, when you buy stuff that's industrially produced with great cost to animals and the environment and everything, that should be so expensive that people can't afford destroying Earth, and they, you know, can easily afford produce that is healthy for themselves and for the planet.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Christian Schregel is our guest. He's author of The Anthropocene, and our email address is talk@alaskapublic.org to join the conversation. Telephone 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call if you're in Anchorage, you probably know that, 550-8422. And from Akiak, here is Roy. Roy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks for allowing me to ask a question, too.
Yes.
And my question is, how is the global scientist dealing with and responding to scientists that are hired, paid to deny global warming of caused by the fossil fuel multinational industries? Example being that one scientist stated that the global warming is not caused by mankind, but by our sun's variations or changes in its impact or effect on planet Earth. And that's what I've been really curious. How is it that the scientists that are attempting to address dealing with these political issues that are battling against science?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Christian?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, particularly with respect to the very heated, polarized debate about climate change in the United States. I mean, I can tell you that in Europe, for example, we don't have such a polarized debate. In Europe, people accept what 97% of scientists, experts on the topic of climate change say, which is, you know, humans do cause what we are seeing, a warming of the air, acidification of the ocean, and potentially, you know, the onset of a runaway climate change. When the permafrost, for example, in Alaska starts to melt, it will set free more carbon dioxide, more methane. If that happens, we might face a runaway climate change. That is really so dangerous. So in Europe, the respect for what the scientists say is very high. In the United States, my observation is that there are very strong economic interests that kind of try and manipulate try and manipulate science or buy, like we have seen in the case you referred to, Roy, last week, that, you know, some stuff gets funded by fossil fuel interests and then presented as science. And actually, I have to say, I would be the happiest man on earth if climate change turned out to be a hoax.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that be great? You know, I'd be really happy because we have nothing to lose. We would have built some renewable energy. We would have perhaps cleaned our industries. We would have made our cities more livable because people, you know, can cycle and walk easier. And we would have made a lot of things that would not cause any harm. So it would be fantastic if climate change was a hoax. And we would have done some, you know, nice things like building wind farms here in Denmark. Now 40% of electricity comes from wind farms.
Wow.
and they don't send the money to Vladimir Putin and make him richer by buying his oil and gas. They produce their own electricity here in this country in Denmark, 40% of it, and they have industry. And Apple just announced to invest $1 billion here in a data center because of the wind energy. So the environmentalism pays out. Now the other way around, you know, if it turns out that science is correct, and but we don't act, you know, the price we will have to pay as humanity for trusting the wrong guys, you know, the price would be so huge for the kids, for us, you know, as adults today, for the kids, grandchildren, and you can add a lot of grand to that, because I mean, you know, this planet will not be the same if climate change plays out the way we did. So my short answer is really do trust the scientists. They have the data. They don't have an interest to kind of serve the interests of some business group. You know, they are scientists. They measure things, and they don't actually have much means to manipulate the data. And if they did, they would be exposed. So, you know, the United States should really trust the scientists, and that would mean act on climate change now.
Yeah, Roy, I will say also that's one of the reasons that the IPCC was formed, was that the scientists wanted to demonstrate that they had an overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming consensus on this. And you're always going to find people who disagree with whatever the norm is. But in this case, it's massively overwhelming, and there's very, very little credibility with anybody in the scientific community that is a denialist at this point.
Right? And, I mean, the denialists, they should just publish their papers, you know. There's an easy way in science to, you know, get respected, that put your data on the table, provide the explanation, and then hand it in as a scientific paper to the respected journals. And then you will have fellow scientists who look at it and see if the methods were correct. And if they were, it will be published. But if you look at published research, you know, there is this huge consensus. So, I mean, whom do we trust? People who have a vested short-term destructive business interest? Or scientists who just have the data they measure. So I think that was a really important point you made, that, you know, science here is at the core of this. You know, it's not about green ideology or anything like that. This is about hard data, you know, undisputable data. And, of course, computer models are involved in this, and they get more and more refined, and surely they are not perfect. But, I mean, what else do we have? You know, we have these calculations that are made with the data, and that's what we have to live with. I mean, you know, you buy insurance for your house even if you don't know that the burglar will come, you know, on the next day. It might come in 10 days or in 1 year, but you still act. And I think, you know, a lot of what we could do in terms of climate change is like an insurance for our planet, in a sense. We, by investing in renewable energy and in alternative transport and in more kind of environmentally friendly agriculture, we pay for an insurance for our planet, and that's a pretty good thing.
Roy?
Thank you.
All right, Roy, I want to thank you for that. That particular scientist was actually discovered to have been concealing where his money was coming from. I don't think he's going to be hanging on to his job too much longer. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
We're talking about having created our own geological era, and I'm not making that up. Christian Schregel is with us. He's author of The Anthropocene, and Dave joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
Good morning, and thank you for coming in and conversing with us, Christian. It's so needed. We seem to be engaged in actually the battle of the age, if not the ages of humanity here. And I've all too often been tempted to use the term dark ages, incipient dark ages, and it's reflected in the fact that we're battling darkness and trying to bring light. We're battling reactionary forces and trying to utilize our accumulated knowledge to actually bring this to bear and do something about it. But the forces arrayed right now, and this is my big issue, we've got these incredibly reactionary leaders such as Stephen Harper in Canada with the tar sands, Tony Abbott in Australia. These guys are just bulldozing right into the opposite direction of reality, and yet people continue to elect them for whatever reason. And the classic case of all in the United States, a once enlightened place, is the United States Senate has refused to allow scientists to bring evidence in to the United States Environmental Protection Agency. I guess what really gets me is how do we break this stranglehold when we've got a really corrupt political system here, and they're promoting willful ignorance throughout the population at the same time. And I find television to be such a mindless refuge for so many, or the bread and circus of sports and everything else, while this huge battle for survival is raging around us, and most people just kind of go, duh. Do you have anything to suggest in how we approach even this? Thank you.
Christian?
Yeah, thank you. I think I totally share your analysis, and actually the fact that some of the politicians you mentioned, I mean, this is sort of, moving backwards in time, and it's, pre-enlightenment, in a sense that if you don't allow scientists to speak out, I mean, this is the achievement of modern civilization, that a lot of our lives is based on, science and what scientists found out, and then scientists are not allowed to speak. But at the same time, I mean, you see, I don't know if these politicians will be reelected. That's one thing. And the other is that, dark forces, if you want to really portray it like that, but these forces, they, it now happens in public, and I think that the number of people who don't get fooled by this, is growing. Of course, if you switch on television, you can get depressed on the amount of, not really helpful things you see there and everything. But, I mean, look at what communities do. Look like what, people do on a daily basis, how they try to make their personal lives more environmentally friendly, how cities try and act like the one I'm in, Copenhagen. I wish you could be here and see how environmentalism can play out wonderfully in a city and make it so much more lively and everything. And I think it's this sort of we need to react to dark forces like that with local community action that is fun and that is good and that kind of radiates this positive energy, that if it's not going backwards, and it's not meaning that we all live like in North Korea if we behave environmentally friendly and if we change the way we do the economy. It's quite the opposite, this extractive lifestyle. I mean, what will the tar sands of Alberta look? What will this landscape look like in the future? I mean, what will they leave behind there? What kind of legacy? So this is impoverishment. I mean, these people like Tony Abbott and the stuff that happens in Canada, that makes us poorer in a sense. It creates some monetary wealth for a few for a very, very short time. And I draw a lot of hope from the fact that I meet a lot of young people who totally see this, and they believe in science, they believe in environmental protection, and they strive to find new ways of earning money that is not destructive. And there is, I think, a lot of positive energy. So let's use that.
Yeah, I think mobilizing is one thing. I think social media makes that possible. I think that government spying is something that people really have to be careful about, profiling and on so forth, because it actually is quite threatening to the established order to be able to organize.
Yeah, and I think that also was really important. This sort of, the dark age. I mean, that what you just said, Steve, the sort of surveillance thing, that adds into it. I mean, yes, this is a big, if you want to call it a battle. I mean, it is a battle for the future of our planet, in a sense. And there are very tough military, industrial, informational sort of interests that will, that show us their kind of brutality. We need to react to that. Absolutely.
That has to be fought.
I've
had the author of the Green is the New Red on this program to be talking about that very thing. Because there are interests who try and say now sustainability is even thought to be some kind of communist plot. Sustainability, the idea of Agenda 21, they call it, and there's actually a whole conspiracy network of people now that are pushing this. Let's go to Herman Joins program.
But I would like people who say that sort of stuff. I would like to buy them, perhaps not a plane ticket because that causes CO2 again, but somehow get them out of their narrow tunnel vision life and get them out into the world, and they will realize they are almost alone at the moment. I mean, if you look at Asia, I mean, in China, environmental awareness is growing massively, in Africa, in Europe, everywhere. And then we hear these voices from America where Europeans always thought, America is the leader of progress and sort of believing in science and everything. And now we see from outside, we see these people who say, really crazy things like that. And they are so isolated if you look at it globally. And I would like to find a way to make them feel this, how fringe they are in terms of the global debate.
You can stamp out the flowers, but you can't stop the spring. Herman and Aniak, you have the last word on the show.
Yeah, I'd like to offer a different view. I know some people won't like to hear it, but if you look back in the history of Alaska, a long time ago, it used to be the tropic up here, and to blame it all on man, it could be a natural occurrence. It's not not right. It seems like there'd be benefits. We'd be able to grow new crops like corn. We'd have cheaper shipping, And I don't believe in the distribution of wealth, Some people, they work hard, and they hire people to create jobs, And what they're saying is give that money they make to the people who are not working. It seems like that's socialism, and it doesn't work.
All right.
Another thing,
Herman, I have run out of time. But
I think, there are business models that are creating jobs that are green at the same time. And they are much better than short-term profits that destroy our kind of fundamentals of life. So there is a green economy that works, and you can see it in a lot of places around Earth. So.
Okay, I'm out of time, and I want to thank you very much, Christian Schregel, and thank you very much for that call, Herman from Aniak. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.